I call the book of Nehemiah, Be Committed. Because we have a great example here of a man. Did I say Nehemiah? Esther. We'll talk about Nehemiah next session. When you talk about commitment, you talk about women. I think of Ruth, I think of Esther being ones who really, truly are great examples to us of being committed. The church typically has a serious lack of commitment. You agree? Why do you think that the church normally has a lack of commitment? I mean, you think about the message we have, the Jesus we serve. We ought to be the most committed of anybody in the world, shouldn't we? All right, I want you to turn to the person next to you. Next 30 seconds, give your reason why you think the church has a serious lack of commitment. Okay, turn to the person next to you. Let me let you do that. Why is that? And if you're listening at home, I encourage you to do that as well. Why aren't we more committed in our church? Why are we so bored with such a fantastic message? If you're taking notes, you can write it down in your notes. All right, did you hear a good answer you want to share? Why is it that we are just not as committed as we should be? I'm sure there's many answers to this. Any of your thoughts? Yeah, but why are we complacent? Yeah, you're right, complacency. Okay, comfort. So if we get really comfortable, then we tend to become more complacent. We need more problems. We need more problems. So, do you ever pray that? Lord, give me more problems. And then I'll trust you more.
No.
You're too smart to pray that? No. Do you ever pray, Lord, give me patience?
Yes.
That's praying the same thing. Lord, give me patience is the same as, Lord, give me more problems. Because how else is God going to help you be more committed to, you know, what he's doing? Now, how committed are you to God's work? I'm preaching to the wrong group, you know. Because you guys are committed enough to leave your jobs, for most of you have left your jobs, and you're committed enough to go 2-3 years and get a master's degree, not in something that's going to make you wealthy. In most classes and master's degree programs, the people are hoping to become wealthy because they get the master's degree. In your case, you're probably going to be poorer getting a master's degree. Hopefully, you're not going to be really in debt. I can tell you the Lord is really faithful. I got all the way through my bachelor's degree without debt. I got through my master's degree without debt. And I got through my doctorate without debt.
Your wife was working.
My wife was working. And she learned to never say never, right? So she learned some really good lessons in it as well. Your wife's working too, Peter. I know her. I saw her at the bus stop on the way to work today. Thank God for her. But I don't know. She's working at Singapore Bible College, which we all know is the best paying place in all of Singapore, right? No, we're committed to do what the Lord wants us to do, but why? Why should we be committed? Why should you be committed to God? Even for those of us who have made a real commitment to the Lord, to say, I'm going to serve you, Lord, in my life, we should still know the answer to this question. we should have the foundation, you know? Never give up. I love this little picture. This guy's intent to get the cheese, you know. And God's going to reward you with a whole lot more than just a little bit of cheese. But there's sacrifices along the way as well. So we're picking up the account here in the post-exilic era. We finished, remember I told you there's really three sections of the post-exilic time? We finished the first one, the time of the rebuilding of the temple under Haggai and Zechariah encouraging Zerubbabel to put the whole, put it all to work to rebuild the temple. The temple's built, and now we're making our way to the middle section in, as we talk about the book of Esther, which is probably more familiar to you. You've probably heard preaching on Esther. And we'll finish after lunch. We'll finish with both Nehemiah and Malachi. All right. Again, Cyrus decreed for the people to come back to the land. Darius was the one who helped them see the finishing of the temple. But now we move to the time of Xerxes, who is descendant Artaxerxes will be under Nehemiah, but we haven't gotten there yet. And now we're looking at those outside the land. In this whole post-exilic period, everything relates to the place of Israel except Esther. Haggai, Jerusalem. Zechariah, Jerusalem. Zerubbabel, Jerusalem. Ezra, Jerusalem. Nehemiah, Jerusalem. Malachi, Jerusalem. Esther? Well, does God care about those who are left behind? The book of Esther doesn't relate to Jerusalem. It relates to the Jews that have been scattered under the Assyrian captivity, where they scattered people all over the place. And frankly, the book of Esther is talking about the great majority of the Jews, the ones who didn't return. And some were living there in Susa, in the capital. But they were spread all throughout the Persian Empire. And the very first verse of Esther says, this is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. This was, I believe, the largest empire the world had ever known up to this point. This is before the Mongol invasions, many years later, but from India and the Far East all the way over to Kush, modern-day Ethiopia, the Persians controlled this entire area. It was a huge, absolutely huge kingdom with, as the first verse of Esther says, 127 provinces. And Jews spread throughout many and many of those places. What was God going to do with them? Did God care about them? Of course, you know the answer to that is yes, he did. And the book of Esther fits into this 58-year gap between Ezra 6 and 7. It's not mentioned in Ezra's account, but it's very, very significant. We know it takes about 10 years of that period, of that 58-year period. And here's Esther. Get it? Esther. Yeah. Queen of Persia. She had all this money, but she still didn't have a straight spoon, you know? Yeah, amazing. What's the book about? It's about an extermination plot that fails. An extermination plot of Haman to kill not just the man he was angry at, Mordecai, but to kill everybody of his, can I say, race? It's not really a good word. Race, you know what race we're in, right? It's called the human race. There really are no different races. There's different ethnicities within our human race. But he wasn't Haman wasn't emphasizing there are common humanity. Haman was emphasizing the fact that this guy was a Jew and I want to kill all the Jews. Now, what would have happened if God allowed killing all the Jews? If he didn't raise up Esther, this extermination plot.
No Messiah.
No faithfulness from God. I mean, his promises, his character, everything was at stake here. And so, in the broad sense, we see in the book, in the first four chapters, the plot is planned, where Haman raises up his hatred. Haman plots most of this. Esther's exalted and Haman plots, basically. And then the plot is foiled in the latter half of the book, chapters 5 to 10. We go from threat to triumph. We go from providence prepared to providence enacted. We go from persecution of the Jews, at least it's persecution is planned. They don't actually get persecuted. And we see that God is faithful to his promise to preserve these people. And we see a bunch of feasts in this book. There's 10 banquets in 10 chapters. That's why I reserved this book just before lunch. Okay? You know, you're going to have lunch in a few minutes. So we're going to talk a lot about feasts in the next few minutes here. And there's, wow, the first one lasts, what was it, 180 days. Can you imagine? I think they were doing some planning here. If we correlate this, these 180 days, we correlate this with the records from Persia of Xerxes, we see these actually plotting to invade Greece. So they were involved in that as well. So a lot of interesting correlation between Herodotus, the Greek historian, about what happened during this time. Well, I don't have time to get into it, but it's pretty fascinating. And yet God, through all these feasts, God's working. And God raises up this woman, Esther. She truly is the way that God demonstrates his providence. So I'm going to put the word providence as a big circle here. Here's our key word for the book. Many people have been critics of the book of Esther. Many of the Jews in antiquity said, this shouldn't be in the Bible. It never once mentions God. It never once mentions prayer. It doesn't even mention anything spiritual. It doesn't mention any of their Jewish feasts. It doesn't mention anything like that. This is not worthy to be in the Bible. So said many of the ancient rabbis prior to Christ. Well, I beg to disagree. I think the very fact that God's name is not mentioned in it is part of the message itself. And it's like your life and mine. God so often seems so dark, mysterious. We don't see him working. It's not so spiritual and all that. And yet, if you really stop and think about it, he is working throughout the entire thing. For you, my fellow Singaporeans, I'm going to speak like a Singaporean because I've lived here longer than some of you Singaporeans. Jesus never gets any credit on National Day for all the wonderful things that have happened in Singapore. There's never one word about Jesus or God. And yet God himself is the one who has given Singapore security, prosperity. God has blessed this little country to be a great blessing. But God's never mentioned. He's never given any credit, at least, you know, publicly. I think you, as a believer, you Singaporeans, you know, this doesn't just happen. You don't go from a third world poor, swampy fishing village to a world-class city in just a few years by accident. God must have been working here. And I could see that some years ago, that the Lord really had his hand on this country. Because I come from a country where it's very obvious that to me that the Lord's had his hand on my country to send the most missionaries, to do the many, many things for the Lord Jesus, even though my country's going through a very difficult time right now. God's providence is there. If you look at your own life, my wife and I often do this. We'll stop and we'll think the houses we lived in, the places we've been, all the things that were just sort of circumstantial, see, people might say. They're not. They're all directed by God. 2 years ago, we were at a big banquet, speaking of banquets, about 2,000 people. We walked in the banquet. We had some friends, you know, that were at the conference. This is the Evangelical Theological Society. And I was just praying kind of quietly as we went on in, Lord, bring us to the right table. Who should we talk to during this banquet, you know? And I look out there, and there's like 200 tables, about 2,000 of us at this banquet. And I said, well, let's kind of go to the middle. So we kind of went to the middle. Oh, how about that table right there? There's a few seats. So we went and sat down at the table. And then, you know, you sit down, a bunch of theologians and pastors and all that. So we all say, hey, where are you serving, you know? So we turn to these people and we say, oh, yeah, we live in Singapore. God's called us there. And across the table, the couple, they were talking to someone else, but they turn to us and they go, do you guys live in Singapore? And we said, yeah, we've been serving there for the last, you know, 26 years. This is like 2 years ago. And they said, we're moving to Singapore in a few months. We know nothing. Can we shift closer to you? So they say, they reject the people they're talking to, you know, on their side of the table. They move on, sit next to us. And we have this wonderful conversation. Well, to make a long story very, very short, they're serving with us as pastors in the church now. You know, Jim and I are fellow pastors. Our wives are becoming best friends. This has only been going on. How does that, you know, and we walk in this room, 200 tables, like probably the only people in the whole room that are serving in Singapore. That's God. And I look at that and go, whoa, God's got something going on here. And sure enough, here we are serving the Lord together through all that. There's so many of these little things. To get back to Zechariah 4, is it 4:10? Do not despise small beginnings. Sit at a table and eat a meal together. You know, that's a lot of us met our spouses. You say this one little funny thing and you end up marrying the person, you know? Or maybe not so funny, like in my case. Can't get along with a lady, and then she ends up becoming my wife for 35 years now, you know? And God's bigger. God's the big God of all of it. Here's our key verse, Esther 4:14. For if you remain silent at this time, Mordecai says to Esther, relief and deliverance for the Jews will rise from another place. See, even here, God's not mentioned. But you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you've come to royal position for such a time as this. God's all over that, but God doesn't get any mention, you know? For such a time as this, you know? God puts people in the right place at the right time. So here's my summary of Esther. An extermination of the Jewish nation plotted by Haman reverts upon his own head through God's providence, through Mordecai and Esther, to encourage post-exilic Israel of God's continued commitment to the Abrahamic covenant. God's watching out for those people who didn't go back to the land. They would have been absolutely exterminated because the plot that was planned was genuinely a threat to the whole nation, and yet the plot was foiled. So why should you be committed to God? Let me just give you the two reasons and we'll go. Here's the first one. God's work faces threats. That's why you should be committed to God. what you are involved in doing is going to face opposition. Doesn't it sound like Ezra as well as Esther? Esther was certainly threatened herself with life and death situation, and all of her people. But God was working. Vashti was deposed. She had nothing to do about with that. But Esther ends up in a beauty contest, you know? And she's much better than the others that are there, you know? Mordecai, the Jew, is in the right place at the right time. And lo and behold, his young cousin Esther catches the eye of the king and becomes queen. How could you plan all of that? And yet Haman is intent on killing every Jew because of his own hatred toward Mordecai, who refuses to give him the proper courtesies. It's just ridiculous. But that's what happens, you know? God's work faces threats. And, you know, we are secure in our relationship with God, but that doesn't mean there's not going to be any attacks. Because we're at war. And we better realize that we're really, truly at war here. So God's work faces threats. That's one reason to be committed to God. But secondly, God's work will triumph. That's another reason to be committed to God. In other words, you're on the winning team. It's not like things aren't going to be difficult. They're certainly going to be difficult. But what you're doing for the Lord Jesus is truly going to triumph. God's going to take that which is built and against you, and he's going to turn it around. And we see that Haman ends up building this gallows to kill the Jews. But Haman's whole plan ends up getting thwarted when Esther realizes that Haman is actually trying to kill her. Haman doesn't even realize she's a Jewess. What a shock it would have been for him to be at another banquet thinking he's going to be honored, and then he finds out, Esther, seriously, you're a Jew? Oh boy. Head gets covered, and Haman's a goner. He even tries to beg for Esther on his knee, and the king thinks he's trying to molest her. Oh boy. You know, he's gone. And so the whole thing reverts. They have this date planned in advance based on the lots that they cast. Hey, which day should we kill all the Jews? That day ends up becoming the day that the whole thing reverts back. And the Jews kill all the people who were taunting them for months in advance. Hey, we're going to kill you on March 23rd. We're going to kill you on March 23rd, you know. When that March 23rd comes, I think it was it March 23rd? I think it was March 23rd. 75,000 of these enemies of the Jews who are intent on killing them end up getting killed. It's no wonder why the Jews today, they have plays on Purim. And the little boys dress up like Haman, the girls as Queen Esther. And it's a great day of feasting. It's a great day of a real blessing. So the book ends in Esther 10 with Mordecai exalted, Haman dead. And it's a reminder to us that in our relationship with God, that doesn't mean that we don't have difficulty, but we also have a future victory because God's plan is not going to be thwarted. You can't thwart God's sovereign plan, but you can be part of it. You can be a very big part of it. And so I think the idea here of God's work faces threats, but it ultimately will triumph. I'd sum it up this way. Despite Satan's threats, God will triumph. Over and over and over, Satan has sought to kill the Jews. We've seen it in the last 100 years where the Jews were threatened with annihilation again. God turned it around. We see it today. Oh, the amount of... The UN has, in recent years, like 67 declarations against Israel, 3 against the rest of the world. As if Israel is the one that's doing the most atrocities in the world when you've got ISIS chopping off people's heads and everything else. I'm talking about 2015, 2016. 67 against Israel, 3 against the rest of the world. No declaration against ISIS. Doesn't that sound a little bit more difficult about any injustice that you find in Israel? So what does it mean for us? It means to use your providentially placed position to help God's people. God will put you and me in places like Esther to have an impact for Him. And we need to do that. Someday I want to go to Esther's tomb. You can visit her tomb today in Iran, if you want to go to Iran, you know. But you don't want to go to Iran? Okay. She's her body's still honored there. And it's a reminder to us that